welcome back to the Dune Minute Podcast, your place to dive deep, episode by episode, into HBO's Dune Prophecy. I am one of your hosts, Zach.
And I'm John.
And we are back. It is Monday. We are hot off the heels of a new episode of Dune Prophecy. And boy, oh boy.
We're hot off the heels of a thick episode of Dune Prophecy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, man. We got a ton to talk about.
Yep.
I'm super stoked. You know, we had our mid-season check-in with the Lorehounds last week. So if you haven't heard that episode, I strongly recommend going back just kind of see where we are after three episodes. And as we, you know, turn the page into the back half of the season, shit's popping off, man. It's getting, things are getting weird.
Well, speaking of where we left off halfway through the season, I think one of my biggest critiques and problems, and I'm not trying to say I'm alone in this because I know a lot of feedback after episode three was the same, where a lot of momentum seemed to have, you know, halted because of episode three.
Yeah.
We got it back, baby. We are just full steam ahead and we have quite a bit to talk about today. So because of that, our episode today is going to be a little different than some of our previous ones. We're going to kind of rapid fire recap the whole episode and everything. And then Zach and I have a lot of things to talk about, a lot of opinions and a lot of theories. So we're going to put on our tinfoil hats and get into it after that. So,
yep. Yep. So what do you say we dive in, man?
Yeah. Well, it's you're the host for today's episode. So why don't you kick us off?
We are, of course, talking about Dune Prophecy Episode 4, titled Twice Born. This episode was once again directed by Richard J. Lewis of Westworld and CSI fame. So I think, believe it's the same director as episode three. Yep. So I mean, that's for sure coming through in these episodes with you know, like the Game of Thrones Westworld feel. We've talked about it before. I won't spend too much time on it, but we're continuing that trend. So yeah, we get a cold open, which is not something that we've gotten since the first episode, really. The cold open is, we hear the thumping of a sand thumper. Emmeline wakes up in a panic and she notices someone walking down the halls outside the dorms in the acolyte's sleeping area. She follows this person out to their little like well, and she, from behind, sees them slit their throat. And the person turns around and it's her with her eyes sewn shut.
If that doesn't give you the vibe screams for this episode,
yeah,
like,
yeah, out of the gate, all gas, no brakes, motherfucker.
Yeah.
Back in the dorms, Jen wakes up in a panic and it seems like all the other sisters around her are having similar dreams. They're all, you know, tossing and turning in their beds. I would say it's a nightmare. Jen notices that Emmeline's gone and she goes outside to the well area and she sees her standing beside the pool with her knife drawn, just like in the dreams that they were having. We get an overhead shot where the pool morphs into an eye with the worm teeth, and we see the blue eyes and hear that weird voice that we've heard a number of times throughout the episode, or throughout the season. Fortunately, Jen saves Emmeline and, you know, wakes her up, snaps her out of this whole thing. And that's when we cut to our intro.
I love the cold open this week. You know, like really, like you just said, it's all gas, no brakes this week. And here we are, baby. Let's go. Mm-hmm. So the intro is the same this time around. There's nothing new. We're just right into it. The only thing that's changed is Mark Addy is actually listed in the opening credits for this one, but you know, and other actors too. But Mark Addy, I think, it just everything he does, he steals the show in.
Yeah.
And speaking of Mark Addy, right after credits, we're in the Harkonnen apartment. And
I call it the condo. Yeah.
Yeah. Evgeny is still pissed about Valya's presence, and you know, Harrow's at least gracious that his aunt is there and everything, and Evgeny's just talking mad shit while Harrow wants to get to know more about what happened during the royal engagement. Rumors have been kind of swirling and everything, and you know, Valya basically says, you know, oh, that wasn't us. And Harrow says something to the extent of, well, we wouldn't know what a truthsayer actually does. Come to find out, Valia is here to be truthsayer for House Harkonnen. She wants to take advantage of this vacuum that House Richesi has left in leaving the High Council, the Landsrad, and elevate House Harkonnen to where she believes their rightful place is. She's going to act on behalf of the Harkonnens and everything. And, you know, Harrow's like, oh, well, I could probably get some good trade deals. Whereas Theodosia this whole time has been doing truth sense and is like, actually, no, you just want the respect of other people and you want to be seen as an equal, which I thought was really funny.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, we're done in the Harkonnen apartment for a little bit. We'll be back, though, because it is Dune Prophecy and we're bouncing back and forth between a million different places.
I was about to say, I hope you have your neck brace on for this one because we get whiplash again. Bad.
This episode is a lot of back and forth.
So we go back to the palace. Breakfast seems to be happening. Princess Nez comes down the slope and we're in that familiar place where they have looks like a, you know, a rib cage all around them next to the waterfall. She's just absolutely disgusted that Desmond, in her words, a killer, is there. Desmond maintains to be his cool, unbothered self, is just, you know, munching away on his breakfast. The Emperor is he's very blasé about this, you know, rumor that was going around that they ordered the killing of the Richesi boy. And honestly, the only emotion that he really shows about it is when he's pissed off at Constantine for starting it. He still believes that Constantine let the cat out of the bag and you know, spilled the beans on their plans. And he's pissed off about that. So Desmond justifies the killing with the thinking machines. And that's, you know, he seems to be really confident in that. Nez thinks this whole thing is a farce and she gets pissed off and storms away.
Well, she says initially that, you know, now that everything's kind of blown off, she wants to go back to Wallach yep. 9 and, you know, Havoco mm-hmm. and her and Natalia, her mother, are like, yeah, no, we need to be a united front as a family. Yep. And then there's that really weird, like, forced hand holding moment. At that point, you know, Inez knows that the rumors are true and that she's not having any of this while Desmond is around. So,
yeah, exactly.
And where do we go from here? Back to Wallach. We're not stopped. At this point, you know, we are starting the scene with Tula not really paying attention to what Jen and Emmeline are saying around her. She's more listening to the other voices, the other memories in her head about how she's, you know, failing to do her part and she can't lie forever. Suddenly kind of snaps into it, though, and then asks for more information about what was going on. You know, Sister Avila is there with them as well. And Sister Avila's, you know, kind of looking on worriedly. Then Emmeline asks about some of the stories of Dorothea. Tula begins kind of having, you know, some, you know, exposition about Dorothea and how she died of grief and everything, or she killed herself because of grief and everything. And then she kind of realizes, oh, wait, Emmeline's trying to truth sense me. And she very quickly knocks that shit off. And, you know, sends Emmeline and Jen away. Jen just kind of stops as Emmeline is on her way out and just says, look, they're all grasping for answers here. All of the other acolytes have had these nightmares as well.
But not her.
But not her for whatever reason. Tula suggests to, you know, maybe start asking questions to the other acolytes. But Avila is very quick to stop her and say, no, we don't want to, you know, cause hysterics here in the in the sisterhood. Yep. And then we get a motherfucking highliner, baby.
Yes, we do. This is I still love the designs of these like rounded off rectangle highliners. Really, really cool.
We definitely see that this is a much smaller highliner than the one from Denis' movie, which would make sense because the guild is building these, you know, we're only a couple decades into the guild existing at this point.
Yep. And what is the Highlander there for? We are doing a roll call, basically. So we get to see a bunch of ships fly down to the surface of Seleucus Secundus. A bunch of names that I've never heard before. You know, a couple of them are important, as we'll come to find out. But we get all the dignitaries arriving on Seleucus Secundus for the High Council meeting. The meeting gets called to order, and we get a familiar chest thump, which I thought was really cool. As the proceedings start, all of the dignitaries just thump their chest twice, and we get on with the meetings. We don't get to see that, though, because we cut to another room where Desmond is burning books. He's just ripping pages out of books and burning them. The Emperor joins him, and really this conversation is about how, you know, now's the time to show strength. The Emperor asked him, did you start the rumors? And he's like, oh, no, I would never do that. But he's trying to convince him to remove the sisterhood from the Lansrad completely. He wants to make sure that history is written in the way that they want it to be written.
And this is Desmond here, just for clarification, yes, because talking. He is talking to Havoco. Desmond is talking
all this.
And Havoco is being the indecisive motherfucker that he is at this point. And he's I don't know if I want to do that.
Yep, exactly.
Havoco does make a good point in this moment, saying that if he pushes for the sisterhood entirely to be removed, then it only screams that he has something to hide. So his indecisiveness is saving him in this point.
Yeah. Yeah.
On the way out, Desmond does have a nice little, last jab at Havoco, though, where he says something to the extent of, the time to snuff out a fire is when a fool lights a match, not when your house is burning around you.
Yeah, I like that clip.
I thought that was
really cool. Yeah.
We're still staying on Seleucus Secundus, but we are in a dark back alley. And what do we see for the first time? We see an Ixion.
Yeah.
Yeah, Duri the Ixion. He's meeting with Kieran Atreides and Horus. Basically, Duri has, dug up what I would consider a thinking machine version of a Hunter Seeker.
That's exactly what I thought when I first saw it. Yeah.
Yeah. It seemed like if a Hunter Seeker actually had intelligence, this is what it would be. And we learned that this Hunter Seeker can cause a big boom. And this is a part of the plan that we learned about in episode 2.
Yeah.
And then we go from the alley into the bar, where Horus and Kieran end up meeting with Sister Michaela. And they're kind of like, hey, this is what we got. I'm going to go ahead and program all the maps that Kieran, got of all the vents and everything into this Hunter Seeker. And we get the plan to detonate the throne room during the meeting of the Lansrad, which, I mean, if you want to start a revolution or a rebellion off, I feel like that's a pretty good way to do it while everyone's in one room.
Yeah, I agree.
Not that we advocate
for that kind of stuff.
No. And, Michaela gets the question to Kieran Atreides of, making the Imperium comes better at a cost. Are you ready to pay it?
I don't think she's not fully convinced that he's fully in, I feel like.
Yeah.
But we cut away from this. We go back over to the Harkonnen condo, and Valia is on her voice memos app on her phone, speaking out a message to Tula about Lila's death. Just, I'm sorry, this happened. She mentions that she's had some weird dreams. So I wondered if she had the same dream that all the other sisters had, that previous night, which is, a likelihood, I would say. She notices something over in the corner and quickly deletes the recording and snaps the little data disc in half. And we realize that Theodosia has walked in behind her. Theo informs her of the rebels' plans. Val says, cool, great, awesome, going exactly how we wanted it to go. All the while, there's this poor spider that's just crawling along the wall that Valia has noticed earlier.
It's an ant.
It's an ant?
Yes, it's a big-ass ant.
Oh, God, I just naturally assumed spider. Ugh, nope, that makes it worse.
It's an ant.
Gross. Theodosia is like, are we sure that we're going to be able to succeed with this? And then Valya takes out her little folding knife and throws it at the wall and just stabs the ant in the, you know, right through it. So she's like, yeah, we're going to do fine.
I will not fail.
Yeah, I will not fail. So yeah, the plan is that we're going to use the rebels to reinstate Harkonnen power. She's going to, you know, try to thwart this this plan before it happens and, you know, show that the sisterhood still has value. So still driving towards that goal of getting the sisterhood back into its former, you know, glory.
And while the rumors of Pruitt's death were not started by the sisterhood, they're absolutely going to take advantage of the hesitation around everything that has happened and use that for their advantage.
Yeah.
And then we see that exactly, you know, that this episode does not have a lot of fat on it. It's all substance. And I'm a big fan of that. We go right into, and this is probably one of my favorite scenes of the, or sequences of the entire
episode. This was so good.
Where we see the sisters all working together, you know, whispering into all of the ears of the nobles of their different houses and stuff, kind of sowing the seeds for what will become a formal inquiry, essentially, into is House Carino covering up some bullshit that they did. Ultimately, doing so, it could be considered a treasonous act, though, so they have to find the right house and the right person to do it. And who better than to have a house that has way more to gain than they do to lose, a disgraced house, be the one to bring these charges to House Carino.
Yeah.
And that house is House Harkonnen.
That's right. Yeah, this sequence was like really, really cool. How just like the single conversation just bounced around all the different houses and their truthsayers. Really, really nice.
I will say, this was our first mention of Mentats. Loved that.
Yeah, that was great.
And then we're back into the Harkonnen apartment. And Valya is just kind of sitting there, you know, in her own zone while other voices are whispering to her. And Harrow interrupts her and says, basically, like, hey, today's the last day of the Landsraad and I haven't heard anything. Shouldn't you be out doing what you sisters do? And then what do you know? There's a knock on the door, or a proverbial knock on the door, so to say.
Yeah.
And a couple of lords of some of the higher houses are in the same elevator that Valya and Theodosia took up to get into the Harkonnen apartment. And they're here to talk business about getting House Harkonnen into the Landsraad and what that exchange is going to look like, because it's not just you're a member of the club. It's we'll let you in, but you got to do something for us first. And that is, you know, the condition that Harrow Harkonnen raises the formal inquiry at the Landsraad against the Imperial House about the death of Pruitt Richesi. Harrow initially has some concerns, but Valya obviously sways him into action, saying, look, motherfucker, this is what you wanted. This is what you got to do. This isn't just free. You got to, like, pay your dues and do it. And she basically also corners him into the thought that Evgeny is not the future of House Harkonnen. You are. Stop thinking about what that old motherfucker wants to do.
I'm going to break away from the recap real quick just to say that the character of Harrow Harkonnen is awesome.
Yeah.
I really, really, really like that character. And Edward Davis, the actor who plays him, does such a good job in this show. Just playing that character exactly how we, you know, need it to be played. Fantastic. So anyways, back to it. So we cut back to Wallach 9, and it's LSD and art time.
In my notes, it's arts and crafts time, baby.
Yeah. So Tula brings all the acolytes into the room, gives them a tablet of like super condensed spice, I guess, and asks them to start drawing their dreams from memory, eyes closed. And man, these are some like haunting drawings that we're starting to see. Like these are really, really messed up. I saw a Slender Man mentioned in there. I don't know if you caught that or not, but they're all just like, you know, really, really weird charcoal drawings.
Falling from dark buildings. Hallways.
Yeah, just weird stuff. eventually all the sisters kind of get on the same page about what they're drawing. They all start drawing the sand dunes that, you know, that we've known from Arrakis. And then what is initially thought of as the well that Emmeline was standing out in front of earlier in the show. And then it switches to a very, very intense scene of all the sisters just coloring in their page completely black, except for two spaces, which look like eyes.
The paper's blue too, which
was, I was about to say, very convenient that the paper was blue.
Also, I really want to know what those charcoal pencils were that they were using, because these girls were just fucking going ham, like while they were in this unconscious trance, just going ham, and nobody snapped a fucking pencil.
Yeah, I mean, you can get good charcoal pencils like that. I've used them before.
Yeah.
Again, side note here, blind drawing like that is fucking hard. I remember having to do that in art school or art class. And yeah, it's damn hard.
Yeah. Well, that was part of why Tula gave all of them the spice, was because it was used to create a heightened connection, and a heightened state of subconsciousness, which would allow the mind and body to work together without having to think. And then one thing we, you know, also need to remember too, is during all of this, about halfway through, as the circles, you know, start getting drawn, Sister Avila enters and tries to stop all of this, saying, look, saying to Tula, look, this is that hysteria that I warned you about and everything.
Yeah. She's always she's just damping the fun.
Yeah. Avila's a huge, party pooper. And I have some things to say about her once we get into our theories and stuff. So
same here. Speaking of Tula, she's doing her best to trip sit all these, these acolytes. She does lose control of them once they start, talking about or start drawing the desert. And when Avila comes in, freaks out, it only makes Tula start to freak out a lot more. And,
Jen in the really corner is freaking out on her own because she's just watching all of this like, what the fuck?
Yeah. So once they get done with drawing the black pages with the eyes and the negative space there, they all wake up, and Emmeline says, and I'm going to quote this word for word because it's really, really great. She says, God is watching us, judging us. The reckoning is here. So, I mean, fucking harrowing words there.
Yep.
So we get to sit with that for a little bit, because we cut away from the scene right after that.
Yep. And we're back in Desmond's office. Desmond's just kind of sitting at his desk, not exactly the happiest person in the world. And Empress Natalia enters and kind of pokes fun at him for being behind a desk and everything, only to give him essentially what looks like a box full of these little glass chips. Those chips, as we have come to know, are data chips, and they've got a whole list of records of, you know, potential machine dealers and potential clientele. And she basically says, look, the time for leniency is over, don't you think? At which point, you know, Desmond kind of gets the, oh, so you're the one that's giving me permission to, you know, go round people up and beat people up and really act, because Havoco's not going to. And Natalia, you know, says so much to the point where she's like, yeah, I set the rumor in place so that way Havoco has something to spurn him into action. He needs to shore up his power. If the Landsrad fears his response to the machines, they'll fear anything. And then we don't necessarily leave the palace, but we leave Desmond's office to another scene where Desmond is got some guards around him, and he's basically saying, look, here's a bunch of wanted lists, basically. Go find these people, and let's make it clear that now's the time to open a can of whoop ass.
Yeah. Natalia's not a good character. Like, she's got her own, like, no, she's a great character, not a good person in the story.
None of these people are good people.
Well, yeah, for sure. But just she is playing the game in a great way.
She reminds me very much of Cersei.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Like season one, season two Cersei before she gets too weird.
Yeah. Mm. Yep. The Game of Thrones comparisons will not end.
I mean, aside from this episode not having a sex scene, this episode was the most Game of Thrones-esque.
Very true. Yeah, that was my next little bit. We get to narrowly avoid a sex scene here in a second. So we cut back to the club, and Kieran is having one last fling before the big day. And he's with, what was his name? Horace, you said?
Horace,
yeah.
That's what IMDb says the character's name is, so.
I don't know if we've heard it.
We haven't.
If we've heard it spoken. Okay, cool. Well, that's good enough then.
I looked through all my notes. It's not there.
Good deal. Inez surprises him, and he is truly surprised. It's like, what the fuck are you doing here? And they quickly move over to a private corner.
Yeah, she's like, you care to introduce me to your friend? And he's like, absolutely not. Basically nope. Picks her up and walks her across the room.
The conversation that they have, I mean, it can be boiled down to he is telling Inez that her father's the problem. And, you know, the political structure that they have right now is the problem that, you know, they're facing. And they need to do something. And surprisingly, Inez agrees with him. You know, she seems kind of on board with this whole like, yeah, we need to do something about it. She does not know clearly that to the extent that he wants to do something, and I'm putting doing something in quotes here. But she is, she's definitely on board for some kind of, you know, action and change and whatnot. And we get some kisses between them, and this is where we narrowly dodge that sex scene.
We do learn some very important things in this scene too. Specifically, we know how Atreides, Kieran Atreides is. He is the son of Albert.
To
remind everyone, is the boy with the hurt leg that Tula let go, the only Atreides that wasn't slaughtered during the hunt from last week's episode.
So the Reddit detectives figured that one out. They called it early.
One more thing too with the club scene, we get more and more mentions of Vorian Atreides.
Yeah.
At this point, he's got to show up either in episode 5 or episode 6. With the amount that they keep on talking about Vorian, I'm sure we'll see him at some point when we probably learn exactly who Desmond is, because in the books, Vorian is chilling on Arrakis. So,
yeah,
I mean, he's doing more than just chilling on Arrakis. But in the books, when Griffin dies on Arrakis trying to find Vorian. So,
yeah, well, let's get into that when we get into theories.
Yeah. All right. So we're back in the Harkonnen apartment. Theodosia at this point basically continues to press Valia about why, you know, she was even brought to Seleucus Secundus, because she feels that, well, she actually knows that it wasn't because, you know, Inez needed a friend at this point. Valia had other motives to bring her, and she wants to know exactly what it is. Turns out Valia wants to use Theodosia for her condition, which we as the audience at this point, we don't know anything about. And we learned some of the backstory around how Theodosia, when she was brought into the Sisterhood, you know, had made her condition perfectly clear and told Valia that she wasn't going to do it again. Yet here we are, you know, Valia is asking her to do it again, which is the key word, because whatever this condition is has been used before. Valia basically says, look, desperate measures, hon. We got to do everything we can because we're going against something that we don't fully understand.
Yeah.
And then we're back on Wallach 9. Tula and Avila are kind of up in Tula's / Valia's office together, looking over all these paintings. And, you know, Tula's kind of recapping everything before Vila came into the room, saying like, look, all of these, you know, acolytes had their own drawings and everything. They're all fucked up and they're really, you know, weird. Avila just calls them anxieties or personal anxieties, but it's like, no, these are beyond anxieties, I think.
I can relate to that.
Yeah. And then, you know, talks about how, you know, they all started drawing the dunes together and drawing Shai Hulud, which they call Shai Hulud, which, as we've talked about before, I'm not super upset that they refer to it as Shai Hulud because, I mean, it's in the film books that Paul was watching. It's what it's actually called. But then she says something to the extent of whatever woke them, which wasn't Tula, had to have been fear. Their fear had awakened them and their mind was screaming to save itself.
Yeah.
Avila kind of does a 180 from the way that she worked before, where she was like, no, don't talk to anyone and, you know, bring up hysterics, where now she's like, well, now we have to tell everyone. And Tula's seemingly the person, the rational person here, saying, look, we can't, because what if what killed Kasha was rooted in fear? Fear must be kept from spreading. So kind of an interesting moment to see Avila 180 like that. But once again, we'll get into that in theories and spoilers time.
Exactly. So. Yeah, it's crazy to think that Tula is the level-headed one in this one.
Yeah.
Or in this case, right? So back at the palace, Inez is planning or having a talk, excuse me, with Constantine. And they're planning to crash the party. And really just throw Desmond under the bus.
Crashing the lands red.
Yeah. Constantine is really reluctant here. He's having a whole host of self-doubts. And Inez is trying to convince him otherwise, you know, with some sweet words. And she recounts the story about how she was abducted and he, you know, wouldn't leave. And he's still not really buying it. He still thinks he's kind of a weak person, and she's just trying to convince him otherwise. You know, my personal opinion is that he's the right one here. but you know, I guess that is TBD in a large sense.
Yeah.
And then we can both take this one.
Because
meeting time.
This one is going to be a long scene.
And we've come to the pinnacle of the show. Maybe one of the pinnacles of the show. It is finally time for the Lansrad meeting.
Lansrad. There isn't a second D in it.
Lansdrad.
I know that you're pronouncing it the way that they do in the 84 Lynch film, but it's Lansrad.
It's time for the Lansrad meeting. And we get a cool, like, suit up scene, you know, straight out of any Marvel movie.
I was thinking the same thing, actually.
From all the royalty, everyone's filing in and taking their seats, and people are honestly shocked to see Valya walking with Harrow Harkonnen. And they're like, what the hell's she doing here?
Yep.
We get a quick scene of the Emperor and Natalia coming through, the underbelly of the palace, you know, up to the chamber, and they encounter Constantine, and Havoko is like, oh, good, I'm so glad you came to, you were going to join us. And he was like, just kidding, bye.
I just wanted to say good luck. Meanwhile, yep, Natalia is like, Havoko, please, you got to get ahead of this fucking Richesi kid thing. And he's like, it'll blow over, it's fine.
So back in the meeting hall, Kieran is lurking in the shadows as one is wont to do when they're about to blow the place up, I guess.
and Valya sees him lurking, by the way.
Oh, like, he's
not like sneaky. Daggers.
Yeah. The meeting gets called to order, and wouldn't you know it, the first order of business is Harrow Harkonnen's grievance.
Yep.
And he gets off to a really rocky start. I guess he's never done this before. Obviously, he's never done this before. They've never been a part of these meetings. So he tries to explain some like very minutia, or not minutia, some very obvious rules to everyone. And the guy who is leading the meeting is like, yeah, we know, get on with it.
Yeah.
And he almost gets it out. He starts to talk, and he's almost getting to the meat of his accusation when who barges in?
Princess Inez.
That's right.
Yeah. So basically Harrow's like, look, fucking this kid got killed. He says that the rules of Canley were violated. And then when he's getting ready to name House Carino, Inez is like, yeah, no, it's the Imperial House. They did that shit. And everyone is just like, oh, God. There's like there's a ruckus across the room. So not only does Harrow Harkonnen have to air some grievances, but so does Inez Carino. Truly a Festivus miracle.
Timely. I love it. I was going to say, I don't know if you saw this, but whenever Inez came in and said it was the royal house that did this, everyone took out pearls, a string of pearls, and put them on and then clutched them.
Everyone clutched super, super hard to those pearls there.
It was it's an ancient tradition.
Yep. Harrow at this point is just kind of like, what do I do? To Valya, he's like, what do I do? What do I do? What do I do? And she's like, bro, she just did it for you. Sit back and watch the fireworks.
Exactly. And she starts to throw Desmond under the bus. You know, she tells him, hey, this was all Desmond's fault. He did it. He killed her, or killed the Pruitt. And you know, he's the guy who we need to, you know, pin this whole thing on, you know, by order of my father.
Yeah.
And I love the like wax on, wax off that Desmond does right here. It's really, really cool.
So smooth. Just whoosh, 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 whoosh.
He doesn't deny it. He comes out and he says, yeah, I fucking did it, and I'll do it again.
And then when he says he'll do it again, he brings out four traitors. One of them happens to be Duri, the Ixion. Yep. One of them is fucking what's his name that Horus. Horus. And then two other guys that I think we had just seen in backgrounds but never actually like learned names for or anything. And then he starts going on this really long tangent about the various predators on Arrakis, desert owls, scorpions, spiders, and wasps, and how they all can kill you, but they all fear that there's an antidote, is what he calls it. There's an antidote for them, Shai-Hulud, and they all fear Shai-Hulud. And it's a terrifying experience, but when it comes, the soldiers rejoice because they know all the other predators will stay away for the rest of the day. And basically, the point of all of this is that he sees himself as Shai-Hulud here. And he sees all the other houses, specifically the Sisterhood, as all these other predators and everything. And he is here to clean house.
Yep.
There
is a swamp and it needs to be drained.
Jesus Christ. He's just like, Inez speaks truth, but it was no murder because Pruitt was executed for using forbidden machine technology. And the entire council would have been executed had the rebels used their thinking machine. And he pulls out the what I would call smart hunter seeker, the hunter seeker with Alexa. Yeah. And is like, they were going to use this to blow all of you up, by the way, and then just crushes it beneath his foot.
Yep. And he from here, he's like, he looks up at the emperor. He's like, give me the word, man. I got these folks here. You know, this is the time to show strength. And that's kind of what he was getting at.
To the Landsrad, he even said, and he points at Havoco and says, Havoco is the leader who will chase these predators away. Mm-hmm. And then he gets real close to one of these higher lords.
Yeah.
And, you know, breathes really heavily, basically to say there's no exemptions. Yeah. I don't remember what he says exactly because I forgot to write it down last night when I was taking my notes, but it's very like H sounds, very heavy like breaths and stuff.
Yeah.
Which leads me down to theories later on. Yeah, he gets like all up in the face of this one person.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, at this point, he's like, just say the word.
Yep.
And Havoco just kind of gives him a little nod.
Yep.
And then he just mean mugs and stares down these five people before letting out a high-pitched whistling like breath or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then everyone begins like their burning process.
Yeah.
Almost like what I would, and, you know, watching it back and everything, it kind of seemed like it was the same, like, ramp up and acceleration of the burning pain that's in the green box that Paul puts his hand into, where it's a little slower and then really ramps up like crazy.
I think there's some similarities, and we'll talk about it a little bit more towards the end here. But I definitely noticed those similarities too. As he's doing the burnings, we get to see a really cool, like, another flashback, but a good one this time.
Yep.
We see the POV of the sandworm attack from Desmond.
We go into his good eye.
Yeah.
See the hand of God.
Yep. And so we're transported to Arrakis, and we see the thumpers and bodies laying all around him. Their thumpers are going off, bodies are laying around him. And just the worm is barreling straight towards him. And as it, you know, envelops him, we hear the same like mechanical weird speech, and we get the blue eyes, and then we zoom back out of Desmond's bad eye. and he's finishing up his burning of the accused in the Landsrad chambers.
Yep.
So, this isn't
comfortable for him either.
No. We start to see, he turns his back to the camera, and we see like blood is seeping out of his clothes. This apparently, you know, really hurts him, when he does this. So he reaches in, and gets some blood on his hand, and I think purposefully puts it right in front of, Valya.
I don't know if it's purposefully, but we'll get to that here later on. Yeah.
Then he stumbles out and leaves just leaves everyone in shock. So yeah, that's a crazy scene, man. I didn't know you could do 5v1 like that, or however many it was.
Well, he can't do it all the time, but he definitely can do it. So
yep. So Valya and Haro retreat back to the condo, and Evgeny is pleased to rub it in their face that it did not go well.
Haro needs a drink after all that.
Yeah, he hits the wet bar. And
he's basically like, Uncle, shut the fuck up.
Valya shows Theo the napkin where she collected some of Desmond's blood, and asks her to get it back to Tula so they can run it through the genetic archives to see where this motherfucker came from, because they need to know everything about him.
Yep. And then we go back into Desmond's office. Desmond's got his coat off, and it's in a pile on the floor behind him. He's just kind of, what I would say, sitting in the fetal position. And we see just his back is completely torn up, scarred to hell. He's got like these open wounds from everything that he was just doing. And Havoco kind of, you know, walks into the office and is like, you cannot do that again. Desmond is worried that he overstepped, and Havoco's like, no, like, clearly this hurts you. And Desmond's like, yeah, no, but the pain brought me to you.
Mm-hmm.
And then Havoco, you know, has a, I would say, a more tender moment with Desmond than he would his own children, where he kind of puts his hand on Desmond's shoulder and is like, well, you know, you have a place here. That kind of just gives Desmond permission to be exactly who he is for Havoco.
Yep. Yep, exactly.
And then we're back on Wallach. What do we have? We have a cone of silence. We don't have a glow globe this episode, but we have a cone of silence. I'll take it. In our cone of silence, who do we have but Sister Emmeline and a bunch of other sisters that, you know, none of them are named or anything, but Emmeline has an orange Catholic Bible with her.
Yeah.
And she's got the coolest, like, finger magnifying glass plus light old lady reading tool.
Take us out of the recap just for a second.
I'm not going to lie.
Take us out of the recap just for a second. Did you get a look at the how like the book is printed?
Yeah.
It's like six columns in one page, which is insane. That is such small print. So yeah, of course you would have to have this.
But yeah, and basically Emmeline is seemingly taking Dorothea's place where she effectively says, look, Dorothea may be dead, but her values and her truths live on.
Yep.
She begins to read from the OCB. And I have this exactly from the show here. There are no truths concealed that will not be disclosed, or lies hidden that will not be made known. When judgment comes, heavens will be set on fire. When we walk by faith and not by sight, we are guided out of the darkness. I think this moment of these dreams and, you know, drawing out the dreams and, you know, saying that God is watching them really drove Emmeline towards Dorothea's notion that they have to look to faith to save them rather than just the sisterhood itself.
Yeah. Yeah, she's definitely picking up the mantle of Dorothea's, like, sect, I guess.
Yeah.
We get a brief scene after this of Jin looking at the drawings, and she's just in utter bewilderment. And we don't linger there too long, but it's, you know, the tension is rising in the episode here. And then we go down to Tula sitting next to the spice tank. Lila is still in there, still in a coma. And we see Emmeline walk around the corner, and she just starts to lay into Tula about her lies. She knows everything. She knows about the Atreides. She knows about Ori. She knows about the killing of Dorothea and just all this stuff. And she's threatening to expose Tula for being a murderer. You know, what happens when you confront a murderer in a enclosed space? Probably going to get murdered. So Tula walks up behind Emmeline and just cuts her throat. And then we get some sand falling from the ceilings. And it looks like the whole place is about to come down. And Tula looks down the hall, and we see a worm just consuming the hallway towards her. Whew, John, it was a dream.
Yeah.
That was all a dream. Yeah. That did not happen. Well,
so the sand started falling as soon as Emmeline, you know, began walking in the room. And Shai Hulud coming down the hallway, it almost felt like a train in a tunnel, just barreling through and everything. And then we very briefly get the eyes, and or we don't get the eyes, but we get the robotic voice inside of Shai Hulud again.
Yeah.
Tula wakes up. Lila is out of the pod. So with all that spice in the air, it would make sense that Tula would have this crazy ass dream like that.
Yeah, she got some secondhand spice.
Contact high.
Yeah, exactly.
Tula begins looking around for Lila, knife drawn, because she doesn't know what's going on. Asks Anarul to come online, and Lila appears out of the dark. Mm-hmm. Her eyes are what I would say partially the eyes of Iban.
The baby blues.
The whites of her eyes are blue, but her irises still are not entirely like as blue as, say, Michaela's were.
Yeah. Yeah.
Lila doesn't really know where she is, but she knows who Tula is, and they, you know, have a moment of embracing each other, and Tula, you know, drops her knife on the floor and is just giving her a big old hug.
Yep.
But we end the episode where we began it after the credits.
Yep.
In the Harkonnen apartment. Dahlia is confronting someone she should have confronted a long time ago. Evgeny is just sitting by the fire, talking mad shit again.
Same old accusations. I mean, it's the same stuff we saw that her family was shouting at her. Yeah, yeah. Same stuff we saw her family shouting at her last episode.
Yep. Only this time, Evgeny is significantly older and more frail and begins having what I would consider some kind of asthma attack or whatever.
Yeah.
And Valia is just being fucking a bitch and grabs his respirator and starts walking in circles around the room as he's like asphyxiating slowly. And she's just talking mad shit and is like, you're weak. If you followed me, you know, House Harkonnen would have been in the place that the sisterhood is now. And basically saying, you know, you fucked up for not going along with me.
Yeah.
And Evgeny, you know, falls out of his chair, is kind of crawling towards her. And she basically just says, you know, your own weakness killed you. Choke on it, bitch. And he dies on the floor.
Yeah. Well, rest in peace, Bobby B, I guess.
Good old Bobby B. It was good to have him for two episodes.
Yeah, it was. So right after this, Valya's kind of just looking around, you know, and I won't say she's in shock, but she's just like, all right, now what?
I would say she's more like relieved that, all of the old Harkonnens are gone.
Yeah.
It's now, you know, the future under Harrow Harkonnen. But there is one old Harkonnen that we have yet to see. And it's Griffin.
Yeah.
Which is very strange that a dead man is standing in the doorway talking to Valya.
Yeah, it is.
And she kind of has a moment to, you know, ask if things are okay and say her final goodbyes. And then Griffin's face starts to do some weird shit.
She says, she looks up at Griffin and says, thank you, Theo.
And what do you know? Theodosia is a Benny Tlalax face dancer.
Oh
my God. Have fun editing that.
Thank you for blowing out my eardrums. I had to walk across the room to pick up my jaw, by the way.
Yeah. All right.
Real quick. So Griff/Theo, whatever you want to call them, they walk back into the room and their body just starts to change into like this tall, bald person. And then we see their skin getting darker and kind of off in the distance as they're rounding a corner. We see Theodosia's hair start to grow back. So we know it's Theodosia for sure. And Valya is just watching this from the doorway and does not look surprised necessarily. She does look like she has a sense of empathy or sympathy, I guess, for what she's going through. But then that's the look that we get as we cut to credits.
Because face dancing does not seem to be a comfortable thing to do.
No, not at all. All right. So
here, let me just change my entire bone structure real quick.
All right, man. Well, that is the episode. What a recap.
Before we get into theories and everything, I just want to say, like I said at the start of this episode, the momentum that we seemingly lost last week is absolutely back. It's better than ever. My hunch on why last week was such a flashback episode heavy, you know, or flashback heavy episode was correct, because, you know, we needed all of that additional context and we got it, and it just made, you know, the rest of this story go through. And we saw a fucking face dancer, dude.
Yeah, I wholly did not expect that. Which it's just crazy. Okay. So but I'll talk more about my, what I think that means here in just a second. I did have a few questions, that I wanted to pose to you, post to the group, I'll say,
to us and the auditor, to me and the audience.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Email duneminute@gmail.com, or you can at duneminute.com on Blue Sky.
The first one is a silly question. Could you recognize yourself from the back, like Emmeline was doing at the beginning of the episode? You know, she's following.
I thought you were going somewhere else completely with that for a second.
No. If you were walking behind, if you were walking behind yourself, would you recognize yourself?
Yeah.
You think you would?
Yeah.
I think it would take me a second. I
have a super like noticeable cowlick in my hair.
No, fair.
Yeah. And also like, okay, do I have long sleeves? Can you see all my tattoos and shit?
Let's say everything's covered up. You're in the same robe that Eveline's in.
Yes, I still would, because I have a big fucking head.
So, Jen lied about not having the dream. I think Jen lied about not having the dream. I think she had it because she woke up very startled. And she woke up around the same, at the same time that everyone else was having it. We don't see a conversation where she saw, you know, or where everyone was talking about it. So if we don't see it on screen, we have to assume that it didn't happen. But she knew a whole heck of a lot about what the dream was. So I think she had the dream, but purposely lied and said that she didn't, because she knew that Tula and Avila were going to pull some bullshit on the people who had the dream, because she does not trust them.
I think Jen had the dream, but Jen was able to escape.
Okay, could be. She's very strong-willed.
There was that line about how fear forced the mind to save itself.
Yeah,
very. Because Jen was the only one that was able to wake up. All the other sisters in the barracks were all still tossing and turning and crying out in their dreams and stuff.
Yeah, that's fair.
I think we're going to learn a lot about Jen next week.
I hope. She continues to be one of my favorite characters in the show.
Yep.
God, Mark Addy deserved more. His time here was great. I really, really enjoyed the time that we got to spend with Evgeny. And he did a fantastic job with the character. I just wish there was more of it. That's just a personal thing, though.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, had we had an eight episode series instead of six, we might have gotten that. But we gotta move on.
Yeah,
I know. Gotta keep it rolling. So,
I guess these are just my stray thoughts that I've had throughout the episode. So I'm just kind of pick and choose from the laundry list that I had here.
Sure.
I guess there are no like conflict of interest rules in the Dune universe, because Valya being the truthsayer to the Harkonnens would definitely raise those flags.
Yeah.
Unless people don't know that she's a Harkonnen, because they never.
I feel like everyone would know.
Maybe. I don't know. That was unclear to me. I really thought back and said, you know, would the average like Duke or Baron or, you know, insert other title for a head of household here, would they know that the Mother Superior is a Harkonnen? I think no.
I don't know.
As close as they keep their, you know, their lineage a secret. I mean, people within the order, or at least the old heads within the order, know about it. But yeah, I don't think the average person would.
Devil's advocate, she could just be known as Valya Harkonnen as well. So
yeah, also true.
We don't get, you know, direct answers on that, unfortunately.
Did you notice that the whispers in this episode were a lot more clear
than they were? Yes.
in the past episodes, which is great. We actually get to discern a lot of, we get things like you're not wanted here, you're not meant to be here. And, you know, all sorts of like really kind of things that move the story along, which is, I thought was really good. I don't know if that means anything. Maybe you have something on that. Like if, you know, the whispers are becoming more, you know, more concise, maybe that means something for, you know, the sisterhood is developing, but just as a narrative device, I like it because it has given us a little bit more when we need it. What do you think Avila's up to? I think she's up to something.
Okay. So let's think back to everything that we've seen so far, specifically when it involves Dorotea, because who was always at Dorotea's side?
It was Avila.
Avila. Yeah. So yeah. I think, you know, Avila is obviously doing the work of Valya Harkonnen, as we saw in last week's episode and the week before, where Avila was not so subtly like pushing Tula to, you know, do the ceremony with the Rossek poison and to cut off Lila from life support and everything. But I also feel that she has a sense of revenge almost that she maybe needs to instill. I don't know. It's kind of hard to get a reading because she, if she does still like serve the sisterhood, she would be fully doing Valia's work. But I feel like maybe she feels like she owes Dorothea something.
Yeah. When I start cracking into theories, I'll get a little bit more into that, but I think she's up to something. And I think there's a through line that we can draw.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's cut back to the alleyway scene where they buy the drone
with the Ixion.
Yeah. With the Ixion.
Dude, we got mentions of a lot of things. We got mentions of Ixions, of Mentats.
Yeah.
Of, what was it? It was 10 million solaris.
Okay. So that's exactly what I wanted to talk about. Okay. So they paid 10 million solari for this drone.
Yeah.
Now, I went back and to the first Dune movie. Do you remember how much it cost for the Emperor and Herald to make the round trip to Caladan for this formality, as Duke Leto says?
So for the people that haven't listened to the Dune Minute, Herald is what we called the Herald of the Change.
It's a good joke. I worked a lot, very hard on it.
Yeah, really just, you know, putting all of our brain power into that moment there. Yes, 1.46 and 62, or 1.46 million and 62 solaris.
Yeah, for the round trip.
Yeah.
Okay, so either that means that thinking machines are crazy fucking expensive.
Well, the Ixions, yeah, the Ixions are rich as fuck. So
yeah, or inflation.
They can charge whatever they want.
Well, true. Or inflation must be crazy at this time in the Imperium, because they paid $10 million for a drone, 10 million solari, excuse me, for a drone, where a round trip with three guild navigators and a whole host of people from the Imperial court. It's three.
There were five members of the Spacing Guild.
I watched it not 30 minutes ago. He says three guild navigators. Members of the Spacing Guild maybe be there, but he said three guild navigators.
Level one guild navigators, because they were still walking around like humans.
Yeah, so. No fish tanks for them.
Yeah, unfortunately. No Doug Jones yet.
Not yet. Still,
still riding that train. Please, if you can hear me, Doug Jones, please.
So yeah, I'm glad we kind of have some comparison for dollar amounts between this show and the previous movies.
Yeah. I think it's just a matter of the Ixions charging whatever the fuck they want because they have thinking machines still. And also, you know, who's to say that Duri isn't also doubling the cost because of all of the laying low he talked about him having to do and everything like that.
Yeah, very true. Very true.
What was it? No worry, Duri, or something like that?
Don't worry, Duri.
Don't worry, Duri. Yeah. Yeah. I love that line.
I want to talk about the club for a second.
Okay.
Because in our first episode covering prophecy, I think both of us were pretty dismayed that there was a nightclub scene in a sci-fi show. You know,
yet another nightclub in a future, in a sci-fi show. Yep.
Yeah. It's grown on me a little bit more since then. It's become a much more important place than just the one-off nightclub scene.
I thought it was very interesting to see other great houses dealing with thinking machines too.
Well, yeah. And that's kind of what I wanted to get at. Like, I know this is supposed to be like a hive of scum and villainy, but these people do a lot of stuff just out in the open at this club. Like the door kind of stays open too. It's not like it's a private place. Anyone
and they're
can
not even
there.
Wearing like disguises or hoods up while they're doing it. They're just like, oh yeah, here you go. Here's the fucking squid thinking machine thing.
Yeah.
Hold on to this.
And this is a place where the princess can just walk into at any given moment. And they're dealing in thinking machines out in the open here.
And also fuck her maybe boyfriend in this club.
Side piece at that point. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just like, I thought I was like, okay, come on. I mean, at least have like a back room set where they can do all this machine dealing in, not just out in the open. I thought that was a little little weird, but whatever. The rebellion plot.
Yeah.
This feels really, really thin and half-baked to me.
So Valia in this episode talks about how she was going to be the savior of this rebellion plot. Mm-hmm. Do you think Michaela deliberately made it really shitty and half-baked to make it easier for Valia to appear heroic? Mm.
That's that's a good call. I was approaching it from a slightly different angle, but that's a good call. They talk about how, like, or at least, what's his name? Horace talks about how we do this and then the spice will flow, right?
Yeah, for all of us.
For all of us. True. So it seems like his motivation behind doing what this is, what they're doing, is to get spice more readily available.
I don't think it's necessarily spice.
It comes
down to a redistribution of wealth.
Okay, fair. I just think like, okay, fly drone into throne room, blow it up, problem solved. That's kind of what their plan is, which is really not a great plan. Horace seems like kind of the bumbling fall guy.
Yeah, I feel like both Kieran and Michaela in their own ways wanted him to be the one that gets caught.
Yeah, I agree.
Which is, there's a few reasons why Kieran wouldn't want Inez meeting Horace, but I think that's one of them.
Yeah.
Either way, Horace isn't a problem anymore.
right.
Homie got fucking barbecued. So, with barbecue time, as I am wont to do, I am on Reddit during my workday because sometimes I get bored between projects. And I saw a comment that, as we were discussing, between other things during this recording, Zach and I both came across independently of each other. But we saw a comment from a user that was basically saying what I had started to put together over the first few episodes of this show, which was that Desmond is some kind of proto-Kwisatz Haderach, whether, he's Benny Tlaelax or just kind of on his own or whatever, kind of falling into the Gola thing.
Yeah.
I think the scene that we had, brief as it was, where we were into Desmond's good eye and we had his perspective being swallowed by Shai Hulud, leads us to something very interesting that was brought up in the Reddit theory with both the giving force and the taking force, where the giving force is a force that the Bene Gesserit sisters, or what will become the Bene Gesserit sisters, and most women in the universe are capable of, whereas men are, capable of the taking force. The Kwisatz Haderach is capable of both of these forces together. Just how the Kwisatz Haderach is a male that can look both forward and backward in timelines. Mm-hmm. Where the Gola thing comes into play is that, and this user kind of makes this point a little more clear here, is that the Gola has Desmond's memories up until the point where it's swallowed, and then it just kind of like crashes out trying to put more memories together. Which is
canonical. I mean, the goals that we see later in the stories, that is exactly how they work. They have memories up until the point of death. Original.
And that's where it's starting to fail. But also, bear in mind too, the goals that we see in the story are, 10,000 and 170 something
plus
years from now. Yeah. So the Bene Tlaelax would have had more time to make things happen. And our friend Dune Navigator on Blue Sky and Mayor Wren, that's Mayor-W-R-E-N on Blue Sky, also kind of did some stuff with timelines to basically figure out that there were mentions of the Tlaylaxu in the prequels, but not in the Schools trilogy, but in the Butlerian Jihad trilogy.
Sure.
At which point the Tlaylaxu were, quote unquote, creating organs for the wounded, when in reality they were just shuffling them around. So they were very far away from axolotl tanks and face dancer tech. Mm-hmm. Related to Theodosia, we'll get to that a little bit later on with the face dancer side of all of this.
Yeah.
But the point is, Proto Gola, Proto Kwisatz Haderach, something happened. We're going to learn more about exactly what happened, I think, to Desmond. Because when we leave, from his vision, we leave from the bad eye.
Yeah. I think it's a great theory, honestly.
Yeah.
I mean, it explains a whole lot, and it would not surprise me if they went down this path.
Yeah. Do you remember that username of the person on Reddit?
Yeah, it is. I'm going to have to spell it out because it's not a word, but it's XBPB124.
Yeah. They also, you know, speaking of the burning thing, say that the last memory is his Gola mind attempting to reclaim these final memories, and all it remembers is Desmond burning. So this is partially where I fall away from this Reddit user's theory, because they say that this person had that this whole experience had enabled him to project the burning onto others. I think this is where some Tlaylaxu or possibly even Ixian tech comes into play, because with the super heavy breath onto the one lord of the, I don't remember which house it was. I don't think it was ever even mentioned, but that one high lord in the Landsrad that also burned, and Desmond having to like look at each of those five people before igniting them.
And he has to like touch his temples while he's doing this. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, your first argument against this is going to be, well, what about Kasha? Let's remember that he had a close conversation with Kasha as, you know, he was being reintroduced to Havoco, and he had that time to stare Kasha down.
Yeah. The hole in that is the time delay portion of everything, which is still to be explained.
What are you talking about with Kasha?
With Kasha, yeah. So
because seemingly the show makes it appear that those two things are happening at the same time with Pruitt and Kasha.
Right. But if following that theory, he gave, let's call them nanobots just here for a second, for all intents and purposes.
Oh, that time delay. I think that's him just planting them on her and then choosing when to ignite.
Oh, could be. That's a part that needs to be explained more. You know, that is something that we don't know for sure. Heck, we don't know any of this for sure.
Yeah. This is us looking at Reddit threads that, you know, we try to avoid, and, you know, have our own thoughts and everything. But I think
when we see a good one, we, you know, we'll draw light to a good one.
Yeah.
Another maybe explanation for this is, you know, there seems to be a storyline, or at least a thread being spun up about Desmond's lineage.
Mm-hmm.
So possibly, I don't know where this is going to go, but it is possible that he would have some kind of connection back to Avila. I've seen this kind of floating around. She, you know, ages match up. Maybe he's her son. Who knows?
Yep.
And if they share a lot of the same, values, then she could have been the one to, you know, do whatever happened to Kasha.
Maybe.
Could be. I don't know. That's throwing a dart blind at a wall that I don't even know if there's a board at. But yeah. That's just something I saw. I was like, that could be interesting.
Throwing a dart in a dark room.
Yeah, exactly. So thank you for bringing that up, because I think that's a really cool theory, and it gets me kind of hyped back up for my Desmond is Gola theory, which I think I was on from the very first episode. So
yeah, during our recap with the Larhounds said that our chances of having any involvement with the God Emperor were dwindling fast.
They're back,
except
baby.
Except for one line this week. Yep. Where God is watching us.
Oh my gosh.
And there is one place that the sisters dare not look. Mm-hmm. Oh, buddy. Are we back on the Leto 2 train?
I am almost fully back on that train, man.
Oh.
So, Emmeline's words there. As soon as I heard him, I was like clapping. I scared Sol off the bed because I was like, it's Leto. I'm almost fully there now. It just makes so much sense if they want to tie it into the, you know, Paul Atreides / Leto Atreides saga, Leto 2 Atreides saga. Like if they want to tie everything back together, which
Leto Atreides saga in a way.
Oh yeah, fair. That's right.
I hate the fact that there is potential for it to be everything has to be related to Paul, but in fairness, yeah. Paul is the Kwisatz Haderach.
That's true. That is true. I'm interested, you know, if they go down that road, I'm interested to see how they tie those together. Like if Desmond is the proto Kwisatz Haderach, they learn what that is, you know, yep. Now, because they're up until now, there has been no mention of the Kwisatz Haderach in the Sisterhood at all.
And that might be where they go with him, is that, mm-hmm. Oh shit, we have the potential to, you know, do this.
Yeah.
Where one individual can perceive both the giving and the taking force, and perceive timelines forward and backwards, and perceive, you know, everything that we can.
Yeah. And then they adjust what their breeding program is for to focus on doing that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that's a really cool, interesting theory.
Mm-hmm.
The introduction of the Face Dancer. Let's talk about Face Dancer for a little bit.
I actually have some beef with the introduction of the Face Dancer.
Yeah.
Yeah. As excited as I am. What?
Too early.
Well, so I was talking with a couple of people on Blue Sky earlier today, specifically talking with Dune Navigator. And basically I said, look, I think unfortunately we're going to have to just recognize that timelines might be a little wonky because of this show. But no, my thing is that the whole part of what makes face dancers is that psychologically they have no sense of self, and they have no, like, you know, identities.
Sure.
You know, and Theodosia definitely does. So, like, how do you explain that one?
She seems very reticent to talk about her, you know, quote unquote condition.
Yeah.
So it makes me think that it's not a secret. I mean, obviously it's not a secret. Valya knows about it, but it's also something that she is like trying to get away from. So my headcanon is that she escaped or left or whatever from the Tlaylaxu and joined the Sisterhood. Maybe this is before the beef was there. Or maybe the beef is not so strong between the two of them right now. And she, you know, accepts who she is. I am this person. I am a face dancer, but she is trying to be Theodosia, which is why she's like reluctant to use this this skill or, you know, gift or power or whatever you want to call it, very much at all. So she knows what it is. I kind of jumped the gun here. My beef is with the timeline on this, and you know, where this is way early.
Yeah.
For any kind of like face dancers to be mentioned. But you know, that's again, like just like you said, that could be retconned out the ass.
Someone might imitate my stride.
I do think though that if they were gonna go down the Gola road with Desmond, introducing the face dancer is only supporting evidence of that.
And that's where, like last night, I was like, all right, Tlaloxu's in. Why can't Gola's at this point?
Yeah, exactly. So I think that they're opening this door early just so they can do some really fucking cool shit with Desmond, you know, later on. But, and then there's the whole thing of like, you know, if they are going to plan on doing like a Children of Dune thing or, you know, any kind of extended, stories into this world, then this could be the opening door of the concept of a Gola.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there could be, you know, this could be, you know, chess
concept of a thinking. Plan of a Gola.
Yeah. Right. Concepts of plans of Golas. Yeah. I don't know. This, you know, they could be thinking chess while we're playing checkers, you know, kind of thing. I don't know. We'll see. But I don't know. I'm not mad at it. I'm not mad at anything I saw in this episode.
No. Big fan of everything that we saw.
Yeah.
Before we wrap up, I do want to talk about one more thing.
Sure.
I want to talk about Desmond's scarring.
Okay.
And that whole process.
Go for it. I don't have any notes on this, so yeah.
Do you think, and this is seemingly reaching, because just thinking about it, looking back over my notes and everything, instead of a proto-Kwisatz Haderach, do you think it's a proto-Sandtrout evolution? Because the scarring looks an awful lot like the scarring that James McAvoy has
sure.
in the 2000s sci-fi Dune series. Now,
sure,
I know that is a stretch.
The only reason I'm going to say no to that, I think it's a fine theory if we weren't already, you know, if we didn't already have like building blocks of a certain story.
Yeah.
The only reason I'm going to say no to that is because the other way makes a ton more sense.
Yeah, it does. And Gola's, it would make sense for early Gola's to deteriorate quickly.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
I don't know. I saw it and immediately was just like, hey, that's just like McAvoy's prosthetics.
Yeah, exactly. My last thing before I get into my final thought is, I'm going to put money. We're going to get some kind of proto litany against the fear before the end of this series is done. They seem to be
I think the litany will be written.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Either a very early version of it or just the exact one. Who knows?
Yeah.
But I feel like we're getting that with the Tula storyline. That's kind of like moving towards that. So that's going to be interesting to see.
Yeah. I think that Lila is not Lila. I think Lila is an abomination.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. This is actually my last little note. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Lila is an abomination. She's going to be taken over by Dorothea.
Yep.
Emmeline is going to be their new acolytes, and Avila is going to help them. I'm calling it now.
I think, and that makes sense because we see that Alia is Alia, but also an abomination. Oh, buddy. Do you still think Tula is going to have to be the one to put Lila down?
That would make the most sense. We've seen her a few times, or at least once, kill people that she cares about. So, I think that would make the most sense.
I'm curious where Jen fits in all of this. Guess we'll have to find out next time on Dragon Ball Z.
All in all, final thoughts, man. This was a great episode. This is a really, really good kind of fuel to the fire of getting this series back on track. I think it's valuable real estate, though. You know, we only have, you know, three episodes left, two after this one. This episode offered fairly few answers to a lot of stuff. And it's going to be a lot to wrap up in two episodes.
Yep.
Either that, or they're going to leave some big stuff to be answered in the next season. I don't know if this has been greenlit for a second season yet, but it's a lot. If this is going to be the only season of this show, this is a lot to wrap up in two episodes. So I think we can only expect more just all gas, no brakes for the final two.
I'm excited. My concerns about losing momentum were put away very quickly watching this episode, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would say, all in all, this episode is going to get 9 Shai Huluds from me.
9?
It's not going to get 10 because there's still some weird pacing stuff. I really don't like the bouncing back and forth like crazy across multiple planets thing.
Sure.
But dude, we saw some stuff we hadn't even seen in the movies with like face dancers, which makes sense because we wouldn't have seen face dancers in Dune, mm-hmm. you know, but it makes me very excited.
Yeah.
To see face dancers in part 3.
Yep.
Well, we get a Gola in part 3. We don't get.
No.
Face dancers.
Some of the best we can hope for is Golas and some navigators.
Yeah. Doug Jones, please. but yeah, we saw face sensors. We saw Ixians. We saw more thinking machines. Okay. So one nit to pick was an inconsistency because in the movie, it's the Padishah Emperor. In the show, it's the Padishah Emperor.
See, that's the way that I've always pronounced it, though. The Padishah Emperor.
Nah,
Padishah. Because that's the way they pronounce it in Lynch's movie.
All right, Lansdread.
Hey, man.
You also say pillow weird, so.
I say pillow, yeah. P-E-L-L-O-W. I understand that.
Weirdo. Anyways, 9 Shai Huluds. 9 Shai Huluds. It was a great 9. Episode. Nonstop. I can't wait for the last two. I really hope that this show fucking just kicks ass to end it.
Yeah. I don't know if I was going to go that high, but I was going to join you in the neighborhood of 8. Okay. Or neighborhood with 8. So yeah, this is fantastic, man. Love it. I've said, you know, we've talked for 2 hours about it now. So, let's get this to the cutting room so I can get it out to folks. So if you take us out with socials.
Yeah. As always. And, you know, thanks for listening. If you're on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, don't forget to rate the show. Also just administratively, because, you know, it's an important week. This is the last week of the Dune Minute podcast for Dune Part 1. So if you've been listening or if you've just started listening, we appreciate it. We love it. Rate the show, share the show, do all the things. But also, you can find us online. On Blue Sky, we are at DuneMinute.com. On Instagram, we are at TheDuneMinute. And you can email DuneMinute@gmail.com if you'd like to get in touch with us. We will be back next week with another episode and then the week after. And then maybe listen to Wednesday's episode of the Dune Minute this week to kind of find out our plans for next year. So
that's right. A lot of fun stuff coming up.
Yeah, quite a bit. Join us for that, and we will see you next week. Same bad time, same terrible channel.
All right. See y'all.